This is the radio industry's very own radio station. 24/7 in radio.
Hello and welcome to Third Sector Show here on In Radio. I'm Dom Chambers and I've really been looking forward to this edition of the programme because all the conversations in it have taken place on London's South Bank. And that is an area I have found to be highly conducive with the encouragement of quality conversation. That's got to be something to do with the vibrancy and energy that emanates out of the South Bank and has done for many years now, since something of a renaissance in the 1990s. Also, of course, its location next to that dirty old river rolling by as Terry and Julie stand on Waterloo Bridge, as the mighty pen of Ray Davies would have it. Well, like him and millions of others, I have a great deal of affection for the River Thames. So much, in fact, I actually lived on it for 10 years, literally up and down with the tides on a daily basis. Ended up selling my boat to a bloke who owned Japanese-style restaurants, but that'll be a story for another occasion. Plenty to occupy us on this occasion. And the conversation's rich in diversity, but with, as always, that common theme about what we achieve here in the UK through grassroots, independent and community media. Matthew Layton is a great case in point. In fact, his story, How Community Radio Saved My Life, is coming up shortly. A story of great hope told to me under one of those gas heater things as February did its best to be quite cold and miserable. But we, and actually thousands of other people on the South Bank, were having a particularly good time that day. But I was also on the South Bank back in November for the Audio Production Awards that take place every year at the British Film Institute. And one of the highlights of that evening was when the winner of the Best Speech Presenter arrived on the stage, was lost for words, and really became quite overcome with emotion. We talk about that in a fantastic conversation with Dotun Adebayo when we caught up after the awards. Now, it is a common theme of these programmes that we explore the value of training in, for instance, community radio. Now, that could be training for people heading into the professional media networks, but it can also be, of course, training on a broader employability agenda as people build their confidences, improve their self-esteem if that's relevant, and most crucially, a bunch of skills that's going to help you whatever you choose to do in life. Well, it was the former of those outcomes that was uppermost in my mind as I headed round the corner from where I dwell by Blackfriars Bridge to the offices of Hello Magazine, and it was my real pleasure to catch up with their new video editor, who'd been on something of a journey since building her foundation of a successful media career on the training that we offer at Summer Valley FM, which is, incidentally, the radio station that I run in northeast Somerset, and where we have a huge preoccupation with training, as does the last person in this particular edition of the programme. And that's Caroline Deal. Caroline started the Media Trust, out of which developed the Community Channel. It's a fantastic organisation, and although she stepped down as its CEO fairly recently, she tells me about the vision and how it was all developed over a couple of decades, and also some really interesting developments which she is getting to looking forward. The one common denominator in all these conversations is visionary people with bundles of energy and passion for media and its social benefits. So let's get to it. And here's a long-standing friend, not only of myself, but also the Third Sector Show.
Hello, I'm Matthew Layton of Zone One Radio and Radio Response.
Matthew, many things we could be talking about, but on our encounters previously, you start a story about community radio saved my life. There's your opener. Fill in the gaps.
Thank you, Tom. It's lovely to see you and always good to sit down and talk to you about community radio because I think it's something that both of us are equally passionate about. And like you, I started in ordinary radio, which is a cutthroat world, and particularly in London where I grew up and now live and have been bringing up my children. The media jobs market is a very competitive one. And I had a succession of six-month contracts and fallow periods. And about 2008, 2009, one of those periods of unemployment hit me quite hard and found myself in the Priory with a diagnosis of late-onset, rapid cycling bipolar disorder. So I experienced both the mania and the depression, and lost about 18 months of my life to some quite hardcore drugs that were designed to slow down my mental capacity. And I got a call from NHS Out of Hours saying, Matthew, you've got toxic levels of lithium in your system. And I was so chilled out at the time that I went, okay, what do you mean to do? Well, can you report to your nearest accident and emergency room? I think you're probably going to need dialysis. Do you mind if I finish my dinner first? And at that point, I walked away from the medication and the fog began to clear. And I really started getting back on my feet by volunteering at a local community radio station. Suddenly I had a place to be. My skills were relevant. My skills were helping other people. I was part of a team. I had other people relying on me. And I even made a friend or two along the way. And while I was there, the guy who was in charge of the production department when I walked in, this guy called Giuseppe. And he had been in the country for 6 weeks. He's Italian. And he wanted to have a go at the radio. An incredibly talented musician and radio presenter. And I said to him, well, look, here are some administrative skills, and here are some scheduling skills, and here are some account management skills, you know. And within 5 months, he had a job working for Discovery in Gunnersbury, like the global documentary famous television channel Discovery, working in the scheduling department for one of their Italian channels, scheduling 10,000 elements of television a week. And he had that job for 5.5 years. And the whole idea that volunteering at a community radio station, not only did my skills become relevant again, but they were able to help somebody else who was unemployed get a job. I think that's what's led me to still be here fighting the same corner as you for, you know, six, seven years later on.
What was it about a community radio station's environment that got you out of that state that you've well articulated to help you on the journey back into full integration into social and working communities or society? What was it about that environment that obviously gave you a sense of purpose and inclusion?
I think it was the fact that I like you, thrive on other people. And it definitely was working in an environment where there were other people relying on me. It was getting me out of the house. You know, in many ways, you know, you and I always talk about the real social purpose of community radio is not having a community radio station in itself. It's what we can do with it. We talk about isolation. That helped me out and got me back into the human race. But again, the employability skills. The radio station I worked at, it was what's now The Beat in Harleston, run by the very talented Ivor Etienne. And what they do is that they have a shiny radio station that plays R&B and hip-hop music that all the kids are listening to at the school gates. And the kids who get excluded from school, who are brought in to the organisation, are told, you can't actually have a go at the radio unless you turn up on time, treat the people around you with respect, and start to understand deadlines and discipline. And I think that's a structure that radio can provide. It provided it to me, and it provided it to them. While I was there, it was the summer of the Tottenham riots, and they had an intake of 13 kids who'd been excluded from school. By September, 12 of the 13 were back in full-time education. The fact that there are other people there is the one that helped me personally. And I think in terms of what we provide as a sector in terms of benefit, and I think we should focus on more, is what I refer to as moving people to the right, getting them from a negative position into a slightly more positive position, whether that be, in my case, from isolation back into the human race, or from excluded from school back into full-time education or training, or indeed the one that I think we can demonstrate value to the government in, which is from unemployed to saleable skills and sustained employment. I'm very proud of the fact that Zone 1 Radio has helped 31 people from unemployment into sustained employment, and I know that doesn't even come close to what you've achieved with Summer Valley.
Well, that's kind of him to say so, and always good talking with Matthew Layton. I very much hope to get to Zone 1 Radio at some point during the year. In fact, I could do with getting to a lot more community stroke grassroots broadcasters in the London area, and there's a few organisations in the great metropolis which are really focused on training. And rather a lot more on that subject coming later in the programme, as I talk to Caroline Deal about the Media Trust and the Community Channel. And we got Vicky Hutton's story as well. But now, where I'm going with the programme is an example of how the Third Sector Show is not exclusively about one sector of the radio industry. And I enjoy crossing the boundaries into other sectors, partly because what is an underlying interest here, and I get this fed back to me when people talk to me about these shows, is a deep love of radio and audio information and entertainment. The other thing, of course, is I've pretty well worked in every sector of the radio industry, so it's always good catching up with old colleagues and friends, as well as making new ones, which is exactly where the programme is going now. Back in November, I attended the Audio Production Awards, and it was my absolute pleasure, after the awards were over, to sit down and enjoy this conversation.
We are in radio.
My name's Dotun Adebayo. I'm a presenter at BBC Radio 5 Live 3 nights a week, and presenter overnight at BBC Radio London as well, 4 nights a week.
Well, I didn't know that about you, and we're going to come on to your tremendous accolade that you've got, because I used to do overnights on Viva Radio and on 963 Liberty and these kinds of lovely things, staying up all night with your audience, isn't it?
Yeah, if you can stay up all night. Yeah, you've got to pace yourself somewhat. It's a lovely thing not having management on your back all the time, not having after the show some kind of production debrief. You know, you go straight home, nobody expects you to hang around. And also, of course, there's a pace to overnights that you just don't have in daytime, so you can be a bit more leisurely about things and do things differently from daytime slots, much, much more different.
I always think with nighttime presenting, that real intimacy that a presenter and a listener can enjoy is more exaggerated. It's more personal because it's a strange time of day. And as you say, the offices are generally empty. How do you approach that kind of, literally, it's you, the microphone, and a person on the other end?
Well, it's all about the listener, isn't it? As you know, it's not about me. I'm the conduit, if you like, to both inform people. Yeah, there's a certain amount of it is being a messenger, sometimes of news stories that they may not know and they're waking up to or just about to fall asleep to, but also a certain amount of entertainment. You know, why should they choose me to listen to? Because people might be alone at that time of night. It's a horrible thing to be alone at night, not least on Christmas night, as you know. That's the ultimate test of any overnight presenter, is can you do Christmas night and make people call up and say, look, they're so pleased to hear a live voice on radio rather than lots of prereqs all over the place. Yeah, so it's about listeners first and foremost. If you understand that and understand your listenership, are they going to bed at that point or are they waking up? That's a conundrum that you've got to balance. And so you can't be both overexcited, although sometimes I am, and you can't lull people to sleep either, because there are a lot of people who want to be awake at that point of night. It's something of a balancing act. But if you know your listenership, you'll know where on that spectrum they are, whether halfway between going to sleep or waking up or whatever it is.
Tell me about the accolade you've just received at the Audio Production Awards today.
I can't believe it, to be honest. I have to look and remind myself. So I'm the best presenter speech, Dotun Adebayo. Well, I wasn't expecting it, as you can't expect something like that, partly because there's a lot of competition. And when you present, not least when you present at night, you know you've got an audience, but you don't necessarily know that other people are listening to you. You know, people in your industry are listening to you and care about you or think you're doing a good job because you're doing it in a different way from people who are much more laid back about it. But also, you know, it just blows your mind. You know, like I said on stage, I've never had an award before, and I don't say that, it doesn't frustrate me. I'm very privileged to be in the job that I do, but when you've never had an award before, you don't know how to behave, you don't know how you'll respond when you get one.
And we do know how you responded. You were emotional, and the whole
room was so behind you when you were having a little kind of private moment, but rather publicly.
Yeah, like I said on stage, my wife won't be happy with that. I was quite embarrassed about it, but what can you do? You know, we're human beings, we're emotional people, and
I don't think you have anything to be ashamed of. I think it's you had already had the room behind you, but you want them even more.
Do you know, it's a different thing when you're up there. You might have felt that. When I was up there, I was like just trying to stop myself from being emotional.
It's the British way, isn't it?
It is, of course, and a bit embarrassing. You're thinking, you know, what should I say? How am I going to stop myself from being emotional? And I did sense that there was a lot of love for me in the room. I did sense that, and that made it even worse because, you know, it's something of a lonely job being, as you say, presenter, overnight presenter. There's nobody else there. You know, it's you and a producer sometimes, or you and a couple of producers. Your main body of colleagues are not there. So suddenly to be filled with a room of people who do listen to you, know who you are and appreciate you, it's mind-blowing, genuinely.
Well, that emotion that welled out of you, there's got to be a strong backstory there. How did you discover that you wanted to communicate through radio?
When I was 12 years old, I went to the World Service, which was then at the Aldwych in Bush House, and I had a contact there through my father who'd done bits and pieces there, and I went there and I said, look, you know, I can help you guys, and they looked at me and they laughed, you know, when I was 12 years old. But whilst I was there, in those days they had telexes coming through all the time. It was the African service, Network Africa was a program, and whilst I was there a telex came through in French. And I literally had done 1 year of O-level French at this point. And I said, oh, I can translate that for you. And they looked at me and thought, yeah. And I just did some, you know, cod translation of French. And they saw how enthusiastic I was. So they said, oh, look, you can come in on weekends, give us a hand, you know, whatever, learn a bit of the trade. And I just loved it. I fell in love with it. You know, for me, coming from Tottenham, in those days, it was like being in Hollywood. You know, if you can imagine that, it was like for a young boy to be given that opportunity to even see people who were speaking on radio and then coming out of the wireless at the same time. It was just mind-blowing.
And what would you say to young people who are attracted to audio information, audio entertainment, or indeed what you and I old lags would call the radio industry?
Indeed. Well, from the old lags' perspective, radio feeds on ideas. Ideas, ideas, ideas. The more ideas, the more original ideas you can come up with, the more successful you're likely to be. But there's nothing new under the sun, as they say. So what I would look at is go out and ask yourself why certain programs are on radio, and then ask yourself, what could I do that is like that, but a twist on it, if you see what I mean. That's what I would say. Come up with ideas. Never stop coming up with ideas. And having your antenna up when you walk around your every day, your community, reading the newspapers, have your antenna up, your radio antenna, to think that would make good radio, or maybe not.
Lastly, I don't think I'd be doing my job if I didn't get you to do one of those tremendous accents, because you presented an award before you came back to receive your own, and it was a sort of wonderfully rich array of accents you did there. Have you got one for me now?
Well, I've only got one, which is an African accent. I apologise to all Nigerians, but it is something like this. You must remember, when you want to be on radio, you have to use all your brain power and your expertise, and you will succeed.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. In
radio. Well, that was a happy encounter. What a lovely person. And many thanks to the Audio Production Awards for inviting me along. Always a highlight of the radio calendar. And now to move from making new friends to catching up with an old one.
Hello, my name is Victoria Hutton.
And I love it. It's Victoria these days, isn't it?
Afraid I've come to London and that's it, full name.
We are in the offices of Hello Magazine. Tell us how you come to be here.
So I'm head of video at Hello Magazine in London. I'm only a month in to my new role here, having spent 4 years at Mumsnet doing kind of much the same thing, growing the video department there. So here I, you know, come and lead a smaller team, but a very busy team. And it's a space where there's so much opportunity for video because they haven't quite ventured into that space yet. So really exciting time to join.
And is this video to promote the copy, whether that's digital or the magazine, or is this video as a sort of venture in its own right?
So the two don't exist without each other now, is how I would sort of answer that, because, you know, we go out and we story gather and we make videos in their own right, and those videos will always be supported by online written copy. They'll also be released individually on our different social platforms, because the audiences are quite different across site and Facebook and Instagram and all your other ones. But similarly, you know, when a print journalist goes out to do a story or we have a big photo shoot in the magazine, we will go along and do a video element to that so that they kind of all work together.
We know each other because you were at Somervale School and you were one of the very, very first people to come in and get some training and to support Summer Valley FM. It was always obvious to me that you were going to have a media career. I think it was pretty obvious to you. Does all that seem a very distant memory now?
Yeah, it does scare me that I'm at the age now where I can say that stuff was sort of 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, it's probably 10, between those two, 10 or 12 years ago that I was at Summer Valley. It's encouraging to me that you and other people sort of spotted that probably before I had seen it in myself. I always loved it, so I knew I wasn't too far removed from what I was supposed to be doing. But it did take me a long time to realise that you can do anything that you put your mind to, and really, and to just believe in yourself. And I always had the kind of interest in people and probably the storytelling ability. I think I was nervous about my technical skills and whether I could keep up with the pace, and my training in that did start at Summer Valley all that time ago.
I suppose it's about a kind of a level of confidence, and the confidence that comes out of, as you say, knowing how to do something technically, but also getting used to your own voice and making audio content, whether that's part of a music show or perhaps a feature or a newsroom item. Is that what your abiding memory then of that period is? Was it really about firming up your own levels of confidence?
Yeah, I think that's a long process. I think, you know, confidence, it takes a long time to build, and you're thrown in at the deep end when you move from an environment like that into perhaps university or further education and then your first job. It's tested at every level, and I think it takes a while to just trust your instinct and, you know, just believe that you can learn anything or you can, you know, apply yourself to anything. What I remember about Summer Valley and how I think it did help me and shape me really was that, you know, we were out talking to people every day. There are still people, you know, my age, my generation, that can't pick up the phone because it makes them nervous, because that's not how they communicate now. So we were out talking with people every day. We were finding the angles to stories. We were using judgment to decide what would make the show that day. We were working in fast turnaround environments. And we were, yeah, developing, you know, technical skills about how to kind of cut features together. And I also learned not to say good evening, ladies and gentlemen, when I was presenting the news.
Was that sounds like some direct feedback from me there.
It was. You were on the chair opposite me. I just thought that was how it's done, but no. Now I kind of look back and it taught me a lot from the very basics right through to some of the technical stuff.
We are in radio.
Really enjoyable conversation with Vicky there. Yeah, I'm still going to call her Vicky. What a wonderful example of how somebody's drive and ambition is fertilised, if you like, and certainly encouraged by the training opportunities and the general environment of somewhere like Summer Valley FM. And there are community stations up and down the UK doing precisely that, leading to some very substantial careers. And by the way, I hope in a future edition of the programme I can play the rest of that conversation as we started to look at what might be in the future in the ever fast-changing media landscape. But for now, it's time to move to another substantial South Bank conversation.
Hi, I'm Caroline Deal, and I'm the founder of the Media Trust, and actually the what was the Community Channel as well, now called Together.
I've worked with the Media Trust, and I know it well. It seems to me that the Media Trust is some sort of middle ground between professional media networks and the kind of whole third sector or community sector of broadcasting. Is that about right?
That's a good way of putting it. John Snow, who was our long-term chair and then deputy chair, calls us the dating agency because we are trying to bring together the two worlds of media and the creative industries on the one side and then the wider third sector on the other side. So that's ranging from large NGOs through to tiny little community groups and now social enterprises as well.
What was your vision in starting this? I think you mentioned 24 years ago.
Yes, I started it 24 years ago. I'd been working at Community Service Volunteers, CSV, running their social action broadcasting unit. And it was really clear to me when I was there that there was a big gap, that charities were desperate for communication skills, media contacts, and also that the media industry wanted access to those charities and wanted to get access to stories, voices, new diverse talent, and neither knew how to speak to the other side. So I actually pitched the whole concept of Media Trust to my chief executive at CSV, that's Elizabeth Hoodless, and said, hey, I've got a great idea for a project. We can get all the media industry to volunteer and we can provide training. But she didn't want to do it. She wanted to be focused on CSV's traditional volunteering. And it nagged away at me. And when I was on my second maternity leave, I just thought, right, let's go for it. And a great guy called Joe Simpson, who I knew from CSV, found £40,000 from the ITV Telethon Trust. So we kicked off with media funding, which we've continued to get, and jumped straight in, making films for charities, running training events for charities, and getting the media industry to provide the pro bono support, the training venues, the speakers, the mentors, the volunteers for the charity sector.
And how long did it take you to build something whereby that vision was really, really happening?
Well, we did jump in straight away because we actually, with that 40,000, we bought a small production company that was already doing charity films and social action films. And we took on a project with BT where we were doing training seminars. So we did jump in straight at the beginning. And then we scaled it up through two means. One, by getting the media companies to become corporate members and pledge 3 years funding at a time. And that happened quite fast, mainly initially with the broadcasters, but then spreading out to the print media industry and now the digital players like Google and Facebook, and then the advertising industry. And then on the other hand, going to trusts and foundations for support. Initially, there was a lot of money around when we set up Media Trust for capacity building. Both through trusts and foundations, but also through the government. It was a no-brainer that there should be organisations that were in the middle there providing support to small charities to communicate, to reach out, to have a voice. Funding wasn't such a challenge in those days because of the investment in infrastructure. We then moved to doing a lot of project-based activities, and that coincided with a realisation that the charities needed to communicate more and more through their beneficiaries. So rather than the chief executive being the spokesperson for the charity, actually how much better if it's the beneficiary whose life has been changed by that charity, or the beneficiary's parents or kids or family and friends who are speaking on behalf of the impact of the charity. So Media Trust ended up doing a lot of projects that were focused around beneficiary voice. The vast bulk of those projects were youth, and still remain actually, youth projects, and giving voice to young people, often mainly disadvantaged young people, so that they could both have a voice, represent the voice of the charities that were supporting them, but also learn media, communications and digital skills. So they were win-win projects. Media Trust still does have a very strong youth media background and activity.
That whole area of empowering voices and empowering people with the skills to make media, which will attract audiences, is very much the language that's very comfortable in this show and in this podcast. I'd just like to clarify for a second what incentivizes the corporates to support the Media Trust. Just run that past me again.
It's never easy getting corporate funding, but it has been, in a way, a no-brainer. So when we talk about about corporates, we're talking very much about media, broadcast, print media, advertising, marketing, digital, the creative industries, you could call it the Creative Industry Trust rather than the Media Trust these days. And what they get out of their support for Media Trust is fantastic, first of all, fantastic employee volunteering opportunities where their staff can either as individuals or more and more as teams be linked up on a communications project where they're using their skills to do good and to support the charities or the young people or the people with disabilities or whoever the project is targeted at. And the corporates say that their staff get a really fantastic feel-good factor out of what they're doing, but they also get a lot of skills development because often their volunteering will involve them using slightly different skills. In the project with the charity, they may well be number one, having to lead that project, whereas in their day job they're number three, or they may be able to use their creativity much more in the charity project than they would in their day job. So the staff get feel-good factor, they get amazing skills. But I remember Steve Hatch, who runs Facebook EMEA here in the UK, saying how the third thing that the Facebook staff got out of their partnership with Media Trust is that they'd come back into the Facebook office and they would say, maybe our jobs at Facebook aren't so bad after all, and maybe the Facebook offices aren't so bad after all, because they would have spent the day or a couple of days working in charity offices that were pretty run down, pretty grotty, realizing how hard charity staff work to do their jobs and how little they get back in terms of pay and other benefits. And then they go back into their flush Facebook offices and they realise that actually life's not so bad on the other side. So that's the sort of staff, that's the staff emphasis. The corporates also get kind of great CSR opportunities. And I think there is a move across the wider corporate sector, not just the media and creative industries, to use their professional skills for good. So rather than going to paint a community centre or volunteer with kids to read or something, to actually use their skills to make a difference.
So people supporting corporate or otherwise, are they buying into the vision or are they buying into the track record?
Oh, that's really interesting. Both, I'd hope. I should say also that the other thing that the corporates get out of working with Media Trust is new talent. So because so many of the initiatives that Media Trust runs are linked to young people, they are getting a direct route in. The corporates are getting direct access to diverse new talent, which they find quite difficult to do otherwise. The young people are getting a direct route into the corporates. So there is no doubt about it that companies like to work with trusted charities where they know the charity can deliver a professional product, that they're not going to let them down, that they're going to treat their staff well, that they're going to be accountable with the content and not get them into hot water in some way. So I think the trusted track record is absolutely key. But there is the classic thing for any charity where if you can come up with a new, exciting project that's going forward that nobody's done before, you are more likely to get buy-in for that new initiative and new project, both from the corporate sector but also from trusts and foundations. And I think it's a big challenge for so many charities, large and small, that often funders want to fund new things rather than just keeping on supporting the tried and trusted activities.
I do want to come onto the community channel, but you did mention a key word of our times there, diverse. And in fact, only the other day, you and I, along with many in the industry, were at the Oxford Media Convention. And you and I found ourselves, I'm not surprised by this, but we found ourselves in a particular diversity workshop. How important is it to take a more proactive stance, do you think, in the media industry? And does the Media Trust have a role to play here in ensuring that there's a more diverse landscape?
Well, Media Trust has been for the last, I'd say, 15 years playing a key role in getting diverse voices into the media industry and diverse staff as well and freelancers through mainly the youth initiatives like Breaking Into News with ITV and ITN, the Vlogstar Challenge with YouTube and the Evening Standard, and many other projects that Media Trust has run. Again, it's that classic thing that the corporates don't know how to access diverse new talent and aren't putting enough effort into doing that. And the diverse communities don't necessarily trust the media industry and find it hard to find a way in. The media industry is still very dependent on who you know, on the usual routes about, you know, do you have a friend or a member of your family working there and can they give you a job or can you afford to do an unpaid internship? A lot of that hasn't changed. So through initiatives like the Media Trust, but also the Creative Diversity Network, Creative Skillset. We're all trying to push the media industry to make slightly more efforts to get those diverse voices into their staff teams, but also not just at entry level, but to actually sustain that diversity right through to management and leadership.
Tell me about the Community Channel. Was that a project, one of the projects that came out of the Media Trust that's sort of taken on its own life form?
Well, you could call it a project, slightly enormous to be just called a project. But basically, when digital television launched in the UK, it seemed a no-brainer to me and a few others, both in the Media Trust and outside the Media Trust, that given that there were shark channels and weather channels and football channels, that there should be a channel for the wider volunteering community sector and the social issues that we deal with. So we approached Sky, first of all, and much to my delight, they said this is just what we're looking for. And they offered us 3 hours a day to launch in 2000. And at the same time, we raised a very small amount of money, really, for a TV channel. We raised 300,000 from the Big Lottery Fund's predecessor, which in those days was called the Community Fund. We thought, well, what do we do now? We've got a bit of airtime and a bit of money. Do we launch straight away with not very much money? Or do we wait and try and raise more money? But we decided to jump in the deep end and launch. So we launched 3 hours a day in the year 2000. And now the channel has been broadcasting for 18 years. It's just become independent from Media Trust. It has become a community benefit society with charitable status. And it is uniquely, I think, in the world, it is the only national television channel that is owned by its community shareholders, because to fill the funding gap last year, we did a big crowdfunder campaign to turn the channel into a community benefit society and to offer its viewers and its partners in the charity sector and its partners in the media industry shares in the channel, community shares.
And what do they get back for those shares, apart from the sense of well-being of supporting something ethically very good?
Well, actually, what you just said is the main reason why they're buying it. It's not so much that they'll get a financial return, because these are what's called community shares, although, you know, they might one day. The main thing they get out of it is a sense of keeping the channel going, because they love it, and also a vote with a community benefit society, which is the new name for the old industrial and provident societies that have been around for over 100 years. With a community benefit society, each shareholder gets one vote, irrespective of how much money they've put in. So we've had investment ranging from 150,000 through to £50, which is the minimum anybody needed to put in. We have 240 community shareholders. They each only get one vote, irrespective of how much they've put in. We then have three directors on the board of the channel that are elected through the membership. So they have their representative members, directors, I should say, and they can influence the direction of the channel through those three elected directors, but they can also, they come to the AGM, they can also correspond with us, we send them regular updates and emails. You know, they are our lifeblood. If it wasn't for them, the channel may have closed.
Well, really interesting understanding the business model and that approach, but let's think about then the impact of how this changes and influences people's progression and direction. I visited you a few years ago, and I spent an hour or so with the people who were in on that day at the Community Channel, and there were some very, very impressive trainees, and they were taking on some fairly weighty material as well. So tell me about who is attracted to that kind of training, and what do they achieve with it?
Okay, so the main training scheme attached to the Community Channel was called London 360, and it ran for 6 years. It's actually stopped now, sadly, because the main funder couldn't continue funding it after 6 years, which even 6 years was a lot. But it basically attracted young graduates from diverse backgrounds who were finding it very difficult to get a job in the media industry. So they were media graduates, but they'd had, even though they would have studied media for 3 years, they'd had very little practical experience. They'd hardly touched a camera. And they came into Media Trust and the Community Channel for a five-month period during which they were trained and mentored in every aspect of running a channel, making content, appearing in front of the camera, editing, social media, radio as well. And in true Media Trust and Community Channel fashion, the support that they got was from the corporate members. So they'd have incredible training sessions with the broadcasters, with the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, with Google, Facebook, YouTube, with print media companies. They'd make content for BBC Radio London. So they came out of those 5 months with a very round training, but very practical support. They had done everything, including having broadcast experience, and they have gone on to amazing jobs in the sector. They're out there now working for Sky News, for ITV, for freelance companies, for the Jewish Chronicle, you name it, they're out there everywhere.
We've reached that point of the conversation, Caroline, which all these conversations reach, and that is when I try and get a story out of the person I'm talking to, where there's been a particular level of impact, where inclusion in that organisation, in this case the Community Channel, has made a very substantial difference to somebody's lives. And often these stories are about people's personal drive, but being in the right environment, which in that case is being driven by you. Can you think of anything to give us now?
I think the story of the British Sign Language Broadcasting Trust is an interesting one. So for many, many years, it was almost impossible to see original, interesting, innovative signed content on British television. Each channel had to do a little bit of signed content, and they'd put it on at 3 a.m. and they'd sign some ancient old programme that nobody really wanted to see or watch, particularly the signing community. And so we worked with Ofcom to come up with an innovative model where the small channels, instead of having to create some content in the middle of the night or sign the content in the middle of the night, put money into a fund. And we created a new trust called the British Sign Language Broadcasting Trust, which has quite a lot of money coming into it now via Ofcom. And they then in turn commission signed content, original signed TV broadcast content, which goes out on the Community Channel 3 times a week at different times of the day and different days of the week. And for the first time in the history of the UK, and I think globally as well, there is original signed content and a dedicated place for the signing community to come to. But those programmes are watched widely by many of our 10 million viewers who really love the programmes and enjoy the programmes for their entertainment, for their information, but also understand a little bit more about how, you know, many people in this country communicate through signing. So I think that's a great story of, you know, dedicated purpose for the channel.
Well, hearing you talk about that, it's really obvious what inspires you and the pleasure you get in telling me precisely about that impact. It was your vision, and it would have been that passion that underwrote that vision in the first place. But as an organisation like the Media Trust scales up, and I arrived and there was a lot of people in the office, you know, when I came around a couple of years ago, how do you as the CEO ensure that you personally are kind of keeping rooted into that vision whilst at the same time managing a great deal of a larger and a burgeoning staff and volunteers?
Well, first of all, I am no longer the CEO. So I stepped down from Media Trust after 23 years, which is probably far too long for me and the organisation. The Media Trust has a wonderful new chief executive called Sue May Thompson, who is just a force of nature and very unusually very experienced both in media and in the charity sector. And she is really taking the organisation forward. Media Trust has changed because it no longer has the channel inside it. Earlier in this podcast, I was saying how the channel has moved out to become an independent channel owned by its new community shareholders. So the Media Trust is smaller and more focused, but it's focused on the area that the trustees and all of us really wanted to scale up, which is getting the corporate sector, the media industry, to volunteer their skills more and do more of the capacity building for charities and community groups. And it's still, Media Trust is still working hard at making sure that its youth media initiatives continue to be groundbreaking and exciting, and which they do. So I think Media Trust has become more focused, and the channel also has its independent focus. And the fact that the two organisations have gone their separate ways, although we still work very closely in partnership, has been a good thing for both organisations. The channel always was a subsidiary of Media Trust. So my new role now is to be executive chair of the channel, which has been through an amazing adventure over the last years. Not only has it become this new charitable community benefit society, but it's actually rebranded. We changed our name last month to Together, after a lot of consultation with our community shareholders, with our media partners, with Facebook, who were so adamant that we should keep the channel going and have supported it brilliantly. So it's now called Together. We have great plans to scale up our income from advertising, which is growing fast, which is really interesting, and to increase the range of content that we have on the channel, which we're doing through extended partnerships with our media partners.
And you're also doing something else, aren't you?
Well, when I thought I was going to be leaving Media Trust and the channel behind, I thought there's a project that needs doing that nobody is doing, which is looking out for supporting founders like me in the charity, in the community sector and the social enterprise sector as well. So I've set up a network called the Social Founders Network for people like me who are founders of charities and social enterprises. And I have already, without even launching it formally, I have the most amazing network of about 150 founders of all ages, of all kinds of organisations, founders who've been doing stuff for 30 years, founders who are just starting on their journey, amazing, innovative founders and really inspirational people. And the one thing that they've all come together for in this network is that as a founder, they don't find support for that very aspect of being a founder anywhere else. There are amazing organisations out there that support leaders, that support chief executives, but there is no other organisation or network that supports people who are founders in the charity sector. And of course, in the charity and the social enterprise sector, being a founder is so much more complicated than in the corporate sector, because you've got to obviously look at all the financial and the sustainability issues, but you've also got to make sure that you are delivering social impact. And juggling those two priorities and those two drivers can be quite a challenge. So it's been really exciting setting up the Social Founders Network, and I have a range of brilliant stories and interviews as well to put up on my new website, not only from the UK but from other countries around the world as well.
And what's the website?
The website is socialfounders.com.
You've clearly got bundles of energy, Caroline, and I wish you every luck with that.
Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
We are in radio.
Caroline Deal there, and there's no question about it that she is one of the leading entrepreneurs of the third sector, and that was a real pleasure talking with her, and I'm most grateful to her for her time, as I am for all my conversational encounters on the South Bank. For the next outing of the show, I'll be heading for the environs of Leicester. And looking forward to that. If you'd like the programme to visit your community, grassroots or independent media organisation, I'd be really happy to do that as part of my tours around the UK. Do get in touch with me, domchambers@summervalleyfm.co.uk. You can tweet me at @TheDomChambers, and all feedback and ideas welcome. And I'll catch you again in May.